Just that this is the last Q&A session. I'm not heartbroken about that. I'm a little bit heartbroken, but that's not what we were talking about in our group. We were talking about anger, rage, and vulnerability. And yeah, so this is the last Q&A, and we have four questions already lined up that came in overnight through the email. We won't be having the Q&A tomorrow, but all the timings will be the same, 8 o'clock meditation, 10:30. Tomorrow we will have the same, start at 4 o'clock with the shorter sit and then breakout groups. And then when we come back into the big room, it will be more like a checkout type scenario. I don't know, I wasn't on the last retreat, so I don't know. I think what I'll do is just start with a couple of the questions I've already had. And then I'll open it up to the floor so that it's a bit fair. And I'm not going to attempt to summarize what Paramananda said this morning, but in a way, the two key takeaways were at the heart of practice is love. And cosmos is manifesting as you, as us, as this. And what I quite liked was how this deep, ferocious love for oneself, deepest, deepest love, becomes atomic. And that is what breaks out of the selfishness and self-centeredness and neediness that might give us the chance to connect. And yeah, that boundlessness. Yeah. And he also mentioned the rhinoceroses on the eyebrow. So one of the questions, hopefully he's not going to correct me on any of that. I'm going to move swiftly on to one of the first question. So the first question was about reflection on right doing and wrongdoing, and how do we know without the labels of wrongdoing and right doing, which initially this person who wanted to remain anonymous seemed to be liberating, suddenly felt the groundlessness of, well, how do we know we're on track without the labels of wrongdoing and right doing? And that's an open question to both Bodhilila and Paramananda.
Well, I think, you know, from a ethical perspective in Buddhism, we've got the precepts as basic training principles and points of reference that rather than as a rule we're trying to follow, and if you break it, you're right or wrong, or there's a right or wrong standard. We're constantly, whatever we're doing, using those as guidelines and trying to work out for ourselves what is the most skillful, what is the most ethical thing to do. And we won't always get it right, but that's why it's a practice, and we can get better at it over time. You get more aware, more ethically sensitive, and maybe similar situations come up again. And I think also we recognize by the effects it has. You know, so from a Buddhist perspective, when we're doing it, we're behaving skillfully, it's going to have beneficial effects on ourselves and others in the world, even if we may not immediately bear the fruits of that. And then if we're doing something unskillful, it's going to have more harmful effects on ourselves and others. And we can see that playing out in our lives and around us and all that. So some of it is like seeing what happens as a result of our actions, the consequences of those. But I think, yeah, keeping on going back to the precepts and thinking that. And for me, that's closely linked to the, you know, we did that puja the other day to Green Tower with all the confession of faults and things. There's something about when you've done something that you know I think actually intuitively we do know sometimes when we've done something unskillful and doesn't sit right, or we feel uncomfortable or feel guilt or shame or just whatever it is, and then it's giving time to reflect over it. I mean, there's a whole sort of practice of owning, acknowledging our unskillfulness and actually being specific about, well, why was it unskillful in relationship to which ethical principle or guideline, precept, or maybe a few of them, was it unskillful? You know, were there particular conditions that led to me doing that? Is there a way of avoiding it in the future? Do I have the intention not to do it? And basically, if there's anything you can do to make things better, make amends, perhaps you can try and do that. And then you just let it go. You don't just hold on to it and feel, oh, I'm guilty, or I'm bad, or I'm ashamed. You kind of take responsibility, acknowledge it, see what you can do maybe to avoid that happening in the future, and then you just let it go. So for me, it's I think we like to have clear rules or guidelines that we think that's right, that's wrong, but actually it's much more nuanced when we do that. And also we have to take much more personal responsibility, because we have to look at everything ourselves and work out what's the most ethical or skillful thing. I don't know if that answers the question or not. Anyway.
Just see if there's any comment in the box. Ramananda, any addition to that?
Well, I think that pretty much sort of covers it, doesn't it, really? We've got a set of precepts which we can use as a guideline, and then we've got our own feeling, haven't we? And I think, you know, partly what we're trying to do as a meditator is to develop a kind of increased sensitivity to our own feeling, in a sense. And, you know, one kind of knows, I think one does kind of know when one's acting from love, when one's acting from, I mean, it's not always totally clear cut, but I suppose from a Buddhist point of view, when we act from craving or aversion, you could say that's unskillful, couldn't we? And that has a feeling tone to it. And we all know what it's like to crave, don't we? It tends to be a kind of contracted feeling tone, you know, a neediness. And we all know, hopefully, what it's like to act from love, you know, selflessly, you know. And they've got quite different feeling tones to them. So I suppose one of the things we're doing through meditating is to try and encourage, you know, give ourselves the courage to act in a skillful way, in a loving way. Because, of course, there is, you know, like with that Anis Nimpo, there is a risk involved, isn't there? There's reasons why we don't act skillfully. And it's largely about risk in a way, isn't it? It can be quite scary to act from love. So I think one of the things we're doing is kind of encouraging ourselves in a way as a meditator. But yeah, I think, you know, yeah, it's not, yeah, I think that's probably all I've got to add. Yeah.
Thank you. I guess if they're anonymous, they're not going to put themselves in the chat box. So I hope that does answer your question to whoever asked it. Thank you so much. I'll go on to the next one. Also came in via email. And I've got permission to paraphrase it. But it's in the ballpark of how do we use Buddhist practice to explore our conditioning and uproot some of the views that we have, especially the ones that might be sitting in plain sight and the ones that might be considered quite positive views and not need to be uprooted initially. And then So this question is about, yeah, Buddha's practices. And you mentioned that usually in Buddha, in meditation, he's been able to touch on some of that dukkha or the unsatisfactoriness, but it's only in counseling or therapy that the views are actually got at. So that's kind of the background, the context. So perhaps the team could talk about how we use Buddha's practice to expose our unhelpful conditioning, especially something around, so this guy's it's a male, and looking at strength as one of the deeply rooted values.
What, looking at what, sorry?
Strength and not crying, and how that might be an obstacle to a kind of descent.
Non-crying.
Crying, okay. Yeah. Crying. Or not showing a vulnerability or any emotionality.
Well, God, you know, what a question. That's a big question. I mean, I've sometimes thought and or felt that vulnerability is the whole key to the whole thing, you know. I mean, sometimes I thought other things, but sometimes I felt that actually, you know, we have this expression, don't we, the healing is through the wound. But I've sometimes felt that the whole thing is about vulnerability, really. I mean, I don't even know what I mean by that, but, you know, this kind of tenderizing of ourselves, you know, this willingness to face our vulnerability. I think the thing about being a human being is we're very vulnerable, and actually there's no way around that. There's absolutely no way around that. We are very vulnerable, and, you know, we die, we get sick, we die, we have our hearts broken, we lose what we love. You know, we're very vulnerable, and we've got, and I don't know, I mean, the whole thing, I'm not quite sure what I'm even trying to say, but the whole thing orbits or is around this whole way of how do we develop this ability to have a robustness around our vulnerability, if that doesn't sound like a contradiction in terms, which it is, it's a kind of paradox. But I think there is a way of becoming robust around your vulnerability. And I think it's a very weird cultural thing we've got in the West that men shouldn't cry. I don't know where that comes from. It's just rubbish, isn't it? You know, because men need to cry as much, you know. And crying, of course, you know, this whole crying thing. We cry for so, if you can't cry for sorrow, you can't cry for joy. You know, this is it, we cut off, you know, and of course, strong men, we don't cry, you know. Anyway, you know, terrible bit of masculine conditioning. I don't know where that comes from. But, I don't know. I've got no answers to these questions. I'm willing to say, the weird thing in my experience is that when we accept our vulnerability, we paradoxically become less vulnerable. I know it doesn't really make much sense, but when we move into vulnerability, we gain, well, I'm not going to say strength because I don't want to make that dichotomy, but we gain, I like this word robustness, I don't know why I'm not. But the other thing I said, and I don't know, you know, a lot of this is why Buddhism, Sangha is such an important part of practice, you know, living in community, living in Sangha, communicating, because this is where we tend to rub up against ourselves, our edges, when we're in communication with people, yeah, when we're in relationship with people. So, you know, one of the answers is, well, we enter into more full-blooded, full-blown relationships with people, and we allow ourselves to be challenged and work communally, you know, it's a collective enterprise as well. Anyway, that's probably, one could talk about this forever. It's such an important and interesting subject, but I'll leave it there. I'm sure but it's both of you have probably got something you'd like to say about it, I don't know.
Well, there was a lot in there, wasn't there? And I agree with everything that Paramananda said, and like how crucial it is to be able to be vulnerable. And I think actually that idea of strength as not being vulnerable or not crying is a view, actually. I think it's a false view that's sort of more cultural, or maybe we grow up within our families and things like that. And I think, again, it's like that perspective of conditionality. Because I know for me, I spent years and years and years training myself not to cry, and I still find it very, very difficult to cry. And that's not around masculine conditioning, but that is around conditioning. You know, I think there's all kinds of different factors that can lead us to develop, in a way, strategies or survival tools that may have worked very well in the past, but then are not helpful later on. And then they get kind of fixed, and then they kind of restrict us, and they become embedded in our personality and how we operate in the world. They become habitual. I mean, as someone who's done a lot of counselling and therapy and also trained and worked as a counsellor at a certain point and done a lot of meditation and Buddhist practice, I think the two can complement each other. I remember when I first came along and there were some Buddhist teachers who were very sort of suspicious about counselling, and they kind of thought, well, you should be able to do it all through your Buddhist practice. Well, I think that really depends on the conditions you've had. If you've experienced quite a lot of trauma, then I actually think it's really, really helpful to have some form of counselling and other kinds of things alongside your Buddhist practice. And I don't think it will get you all the way, maybe, without it, or maybe it'll take you a lot longer, and then why not have that support? They can complement each other. I think my experience was, there was a time when I was getting all kinds of insights in my therapy, and then actually working with it in meditation in my Buddhist practice was really helpful, or something would come up in my meditation that I then take to counselling or whatever, and they work well together. And I think for a while I was a bit confused about what was the difference, really, because they did seem to be both of them making me much more aware of my past and my conditioning and freeing me to sort of try new things and to change. But I do think there's sort of very fundamental difference in terms of maybe a therapeutic approach is trying to sort of heal and make things better now and make you into a happy, healthy, functioning human being in the world, whereas there's a different, I mean, that whole kind of relief of suffering and liberation and the altruistic element and the ethical element aren't necessarily there in the same way. And I think with the Buddhist practice, it's having that Buddhist perspective and then aligning your whole life around it can really just help, you know, whatever else you're doing within it makes sense. Because I think for me there are a lot of different therapeutic models, and some of them work for some people or for some things, but I've never found one that is like all size fits all and everybody and every situation. Whereas for me the Dharma provides a framework of, you know, something that's really true, that has, I can apply to everything, actually. And that has been really, really helpful. And so what am I saying? Anyway, I guess I kind of feel like I don't think it has to be either or. I think everybody needs to kind of work out what works for them.
Right, so if we just add about crying, I think crying is a moistening, a very necessary moistening. If you don't cry, you kind of try to dry up. Soul becomes dried. Crying is a moistening activity. It should be liberally practiced by all of us.
I mean, I think some of the reason we don't cry and other people are uncomfortable when people are crying is much more about not wanting to get in touch with our pain and our fear. And if somebody else is doing that, then that kind of is uncomfortable for us because we get reminded of our own.
It's one side of crying, isn't it? I mean, I cry a lot these days, but I mean, very often I wouldn't say I'm crying because I'm sad. Not even quite sure why I'm crying. It's just a sort of watering of the garden, as it were. I don't know. It's just emotion, you know. It's not negative. I don't experience it as negative at all. But I'm not crying over because I'm being hurt or I'm sad. I'm just crying because there's a kind of there's a kind of excess of emotion, you know, of usually quite tender, positive emotions. I don't think. I mean, obviously, sometimes we cry because we're sad as well.
But, But I think it's interesting that actually sometimes people just find excess of emotion uncomfortable, whether you're crying because you're happy or whether you're crying because you're sad.
Wow, yeah, I mean, but you know, yeah, sure. I wouldn't
let
that.
British, is it?
Don't let that put you off, though. You know, don't worry about that. I used to be embarrassed. I mean, I cry a lot in the scrying room, you know, doing stuff. First of all, I used to feel a bit embarrassed about it, but these days I don't feel at all embarrassed about it. You know. It's what's happening, isn't it? If other people feel embarrassed on my behalf, well, I appreciate that. But as I can't see them, it doesn't really bother me, do you say?
Okay. Yeah, thank you for your answers and guidance. So much food for thought. Yes. So I know we've only got a few minutes left, but let's have one question from the field. It would be nice to hear someone else's voice.
Yeah.
And don't forget to say your name as well, please.
Abby here with an American accent. I don't know, Paramananda, if you could elaborate a little bit more on your stardust carbon origins of we human material folk and are coming in and are going out it back into the cosmos, i.e. our birthing and dying. Small subject.
Do you know, Abby, I don't really know. Like, I can, you know, I'm sure those are a lot better. I'm sure you can go on the internet and find them a lot better explanation. Do you mean scientifically or?
I don't mean scientifically.
Oh, okay.
Or just your.
It's my, well. I don't know what to say about it, really. I mean, I say what I say. I mean, I think the thing about, you know, maybe it's worth me saying, you know, when I'm teaching it, it's a certain context, isn't it? And I'm allowing myself quite a lot of poetic liberty, you know. So I don't want anybody to take what I say as I don't even know what it would mean to say it's true or not true, you know. I mean, if you, I don't know, that last book I wrote, you know, The Myth of Meditation, I was trying to say that actually, you know, meditation isn't primarily a technique. Of course, it is a technique, or it could be thought of as a technique, but actually, it's a kind of living out, or it's kind of feeling into a particular mythic way of being in the world. It's underpinned by a particular, I'm using the word mythic, I mean, in a way I prefer the word poetic, a poetic way of being in the world. So while it's literally true, evidently, well, not, you know, quite obviously so really, that all the material that makes us up has come from the stars, you know. Evidently, a lot of it is generated in black holes, I think they reckon. But anyway, so it's kind of literally true that the actual material, atomic material, subatomic material, I'm not, and that is in itself very interesting. I think, you know, poetically, it's, you know, poetically, just opening, you know, it opens. And of course, when you understand yourself in that way, you know, of course, death is simply the death of the ego, isn't it? Just a particular configuration. And, you know, it's not the death of what you're actually essentially made from. So maybe also a lesson to fear of death, perhaps. I think maybe it's worth adding, this is going totally off the point you're asking, Abby, but just as a coming back to these views, I think one thing to really look out for about views is when you hold a view very tightly in exclusion from any other view, even if it seems to be a good view, I think that, you know, like that's when you should be when you should be suspicious about your view. You know, if you hold something very strongly, and then you've got monotheistic, aren't you? If you become monotheistic, I think that's quite something to be cautious, careful about. You know, I love Hillman's. I think I've already referred to Hillman's expression. He quite often remarks that the gods never appear alone, by which he means there's never just one view. There's never just one view. And I think this is very important when we're talking about meditation. Anything I say about meditation, well, probably a good case could be made for the opposite, you know. And to realise that, you know, there's not, or anyway, it's deep, I won't say more because it's opening up these things, but, you know, beware of monotheistic views, you know, views that are in opposition to everything else.
And that includes around Buddhist practice and all that. And it's, it's not that unusual to run the risk of becoming a born-again Buddhist, you know. So I think it's the whole mechanism of being attached to our views and the underlying views that are not seeing things as they are, really. That's the issue. And that's, you know, in terms of ethics, in terms of wisdom, you know, that's the delusion. The spiritual ignorance, which also underlies our ethical action and our practice. You know, we're trying to see through those views, even if they might be ones that are accepted or feel good or whatever, they're still a view.
Okay, it's half past five.
Okay.
A couple of questions that didn't get asked, but we'll chat in the team perhaps, and we may or may not get a reply to you. We'll see if we can. As you know, some of these questions are best answered spoken, carry much more meaning. Okay. Thank you so much, everybody, for your questions. Very entertaining is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, fruitful. And passing you over to Praninita for the final goodbyes.
Thank you, Sophie.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
So, thank you, everyone.